now for something completely different.
Welcome to Shout Out. Out of the closet and into your ears.
Hello and welcome to Shout Out. I'm Andy Shilton.
And I'm RB Fenchurch. On today's show, The Joshua Abomination.
Ez catches up with the author of this queer leadership book, and all things rubber and leather are also coming up.
And that's from the Seth West Fetish team. They're live in the studio with us tonight.
All today, coming here on Shout Out.
Hello,
everyone.
Hello, did you miss my bomber bombs?
Yes.
Oh, we've missed them so much.
Thank you so, so much. It's wonderful to be back doing the bomber bombs.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
So, couldn't you, you like when you weren't here, it was sunny, and now you hear it's rainy.
Sorry.
Can you take it away again?
No. I wish I could. I wish I had that power. But isn't it just the gays that control the weather?
Or, oh, yeah, totally.
Or is it the
whole sorry, Terry, can you stop it, please?
Boom. Yeah, so I'm not going to take accountability for that one.
But speaking of which, it's very hot in the studio. I think someone's turned the air on.
It is super duper warm.
It is warm, isn't it?
Yeah. How are you?
I'm good.
Good.
I'm good. I'm not driving the desk tonight. I'll be taking the reins.
Yes.
Yes, yes. All the dead air's my fault. Thank you.
Well, we've all got to learn somewhere. Yes. I'm too nervous to even twiddle any knobs.
And I know from when the dead air is made of me. Is that true, Steph?
How would I know?
Yeah, you don't want to let me loose over there.
We have got some fetish stuff coming up later on.
Yeah, absolutely. So, which is going to be really interesting.
Hypnotherapy, too.
Hypnotherapy?
Hypnotism, yes.
Yeah, slightly different.
So I looked at Tara when I said that, and it reminded me of therapy and stuff. Yeah, you don't do hypnotherapy, though, do you? You do therapy, yeah.
Yeah. I've been hypnotised.
Have you?
Many years ago.
What's your trigger word? Can we turn you back into a chicken now?
No, I mean, I was about 18, so, 3 years ago, and I remember it well. I was, I believed I was a zookeeper. And all the other people were the animals.
Is Steffi your penguin then?
Yeah, yes.
Squawk. It's the way I walk.
With your little waddle, absolutely.
We hypnotise Terry too. He keeps thinking Tom Daly's underneath his stairs.
Yeah.
No, I know that he's actually just a
figment. Sort of I don't know if that's worse or not.
My deranged imagination. Yes. But it just indulge me. It keeps me happy, doesn't it, in the corner?
Of course.
Speaking of Tom
Now, talk to me about the Joshua Abomination.
Yeah, so we've got a really interesting interview coming up that I haven't done an interview for a long while. And speaking with Mark was, he's a prolific writer, but he's having a break. As recently, I think he's written four books now, and they all follow on from one another, but they also... can stand alone. I don't want to say too much, really, because he speaks beautifully in the interview, and it's a very, very unique unique piece of literature that he's put together, bringing together facts and fiction and fantasy, romance, gay love. Cool. Yeah.
Well, shall we have a listen?
Oh, go on then.
Go on then.
Okay, that's over to me then, isn't it?
Yes.
I've got to press the button now. Okay, here we go.
Today we are joined by Mark Asked. He is an author who writes queer stories that are complex and political and unapologetically imaginative. And today he's going to be talking to us about his books. We're very excited to speak with him. Hello, Mark.
Yeah, hi. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Very, very well. And yourself?
I'm fine, sitting here in Florida.
So thank you for coming on to Shout Out. I know the listeners are going to really enjoy hearing all about you and your books. Could you tell us what got you into writing? Where did that passion start? What did you first start writing?
Well, it's late in life. I'm an older person, and I started towards the first year of COVID. I was sitting home, and I had nothing to do. We were all in exile almost. We weren't really doing much, couldn't go out. And these stories came to me at like 2 a.m. in the morning, sleeping. And I found that I had to get up and write them down before I could go back to sleep. Otherwise, I keep repeating them in my head. But once I wrote them down, I was fine. I could sleep. And so I started writing them down. All of a sudden, I had 5-10 pages of handwritten notes or thoughts. And I said, you know, I better start to organize this stuff. And once I started typing on the computer to organize it, I said, wait a second, this is becoming a book. I mean, that's how I got into it. I backed into it. I didn't know I was going to be an author. And then the first book was done. And then all of a sudden, well, I'm now completed four books and they just keep coming. And I've taken a time off right now. I'm not going to write another book for a year. I have to get my life back. And that's basically where it is. So the four books, the one is King Herod's Treasure. That's the first book. And that's basically a gay romance between an older gay guy, which is loosely based on myself, I have to tell you, and a young dashing archaeologist, which he meets in Israel when he goes to visit. And that character is a sort of a composite of the gay lovers I've had over the course of my life. It took a little bit of each and sort of made a character out of him. And it's a fun adventure, actually. It's a very simple love story. I find that most people like that book the best. It's a simple love story of discovery, how they're, you know, evolving and how they have certain adventures along the way, and they discover each other through these different adventures. They finally find treasure. And I'm an amateur archaeologist, so I brought that in when they meet in Israel. It's also a love story to modern Israel too, because it's a travelogue, and without any apology for it, Israel can be a lot of fun. And so, especially if you're an amateur archaeologist, because there's so many different levels of everything around you, and they go from one little adventure to another. They finally get to Jerusalem, and through an accidental observation by the older gentleman, they go on a treasure hunt, and they find treasure. And I don't want to go anywhere into it, but it's fun and games and dangerous, and it's the premise of the book, basically, other than the self-discovery of romance between these two very different people, is that, you know, we all know about the destruction of the temple in the Jewish temple in 70 AD, where the Romans came in and conquered the country and destroyed the camp and sacked the temple of all the gold. Well, my premise is that there was a separate parallel royal treasure that King Herod had that had nothing to do with the priest's treasure. And one of the reasons that the Romans initially destroyed half the city, because they conquered it, and that's how they did war back then. But they destroyed the other half of the city, not because they were particularly anti-Semitic, because anti-Semitism didn't exist back then in the form we have it today. They were treasure hunting. They destroyed the other half of the city looking for this royal treasure. And you would say, well, why were they doing that? Because the general who sacked Jerusalem, the love of his life was Berenice, who was the granddaughter of King Herod. And she had her eye on her family jewels. I know her country was in flames and whatever, but she was probably constantly asking him, what happened to all the jewels? And so he had his soldiers looking, and they never found them until, you know, the accidental observation of this older guy from one of the walls of modern Jerusalem. He notices a discrepancy in one of the parks outside the city. And one thing leads to another, and his younger companion, later on, husband and lover, but at that point companion, is a professional archaeologist, in addition to being a very handsome movie star kind of a guy. But he The archaeologist was reluctant to go look for this stuff because he said the city is, there's so much other things to see in the city, but the old guy insisted. And sure enough, one thing led to another and it was a major find. So that's the first story. And a lot of people like that. It's fun. They go camel riding in the Negev and they have naked swims, nude swims in hidden grottos, and they have a fight with a gang of Arabs on a nude gay beach at 12 midnight.
I mean, of course they do. What else would they be doing?
They have lots of adventures doing this, and amongst other things, lots of other stuff. So it's a fun novel. The second book that I wrote, the Secrets of the Saffron Mountain. The Saffron Mountain is the English saffron is the English translation of the Arabic word Karkum. And there is a mountain in the Negev called Mount Karkum, Mount Saffron. And in it is a rock fixture where a certain time of the year, the light comes from behind it and it looks like a burning bush. And that's the origin, I believe. And not only I, but a lot of archaeologists believe that that's the origin of the story of the burning bush. And they go on to discovery. The other premise is that when Moses leads the Hebrews out of Egypt, they mention they took the treasury of Egypt with them. It's in the Bible. They tell them they took the gold of Egypt with them. Well, what happened to all that gold? And so I tie that Negev Mount Karkum into another treasure hunt for the treasure of Egypt taken out by Exodus and what happened to it. And they discover it too. It's a successful treasure ultimately. And the third book is called The Mossad Warrior Spy. And the secret of the young guy archaeologist, which he now is married to in the third book, is that he is still an active Mossad agent. He told his Mark Cohn, his older lover, that he had retired from Mossad, but it was a lie. He was still very much active. And they have a lot of fighting in the jungles of Africa, terrorists, and kidnapping busloads of Israeli tourists, and what happens. And there's a bit of science fiction in it because I introduce certain early stage laser weaponry and anti-gravity battleships that can fly. It's not too much of a jump from what's happening actually right now, but I've sort of developed that with those weapon systems maybe another 50 to 100 years in the future and said they're here now, that sort of thing, and which is a surprise to everybody. And it makes for an exciting, and then finally they have a fight. There's a lot of bad things that happen. The third book is where it starts to get a little darker, and there's some bad stuff that happens to the younger character there, and he develops some PTSD, and he goes to a resort that's secretly owned by the Mossad in the Canary Islands, and on the very tip there to relax. And lo and behold, there's a political revolution in Israel, and they want to kill him. And anyway, they have a fight on the volcano in Tenerife, and it's really quite fun. I mean, in a serious sense of what happens there. There's people die in that book. This is getting into espionage and Mossad and Middle Eastern politics. The fourth book delves where they're married and he decides to run for a prime minister as the first gay prime minister. But his records of PTSD and mental instability have been sealed by friends of his in the government. But he is unstable, this young guy. You're not so young anymore. But he gets to be the prime minister. It runs at a certain, but really, he has the access to certain technologies, and he develops, or he further develops, robots, and it becomes a killer robot army. And what he does with it, the last part of that book is, well, it can be considered genocidal about what happens with that killer robot army. But again, I bring in archaeology, and there's a silver trumpet that was part of the temple that was lost forever, the temple relics that were lost forever and comes back. And there's a young guy who is descended from the temple priests who can blow the trumpet and call God to help them fight off these robots and all that. It gets very metaphysical and science fiction, and it gets all tied up into one. And it's a darker book. There's a lot of people who die. And I find that the people who like my last two books really don't like the first two. And the people who love the first two really don't like the last two, because it's a different temp. The books are a different tempo. The first two books are fun. So that's what my feedback is from these books so far. So if you like high romance and adventure and fun adventure, and it's a bit of a love story to Israel too, the first two books, sure, they're fun. I would highly recommend them. But if you're more into espionage and Middle Eastern politics and let's face it, assassinations, then you'd probably be more interested in the last two books.
Thank you for that explanation and taking us on that journey of the timeline of the books. I could really visualize it, and it was sort of listening and also thinking about how it just came to you in the middle of the night, and that one moment really has been transformative for you, to have, you know, those images and write those down, and then from that put that into not one book but four. Tells a love story, but so much more than that, and putting your passions into those books as well.
The love story is paramount in the first two books. It's there in the last two books, but it's not the most important part of the last two books. I write, you know, I've been told that people write, writers, there are two types of writers, the ones that structure, they do an outline of what they're going to write before they write one word. They know the beginning, the middle, and the end. And it's all very structured, and they know where they're going, and they're just filling in. The way I write is that I know my characters so well, especially since one of them is loosely based on me and the other one is loosely based on these boyfriends I've had over the years, that if I present them with certain situations, which I kind of fantasize and come up with, I know how they will react. So I write and let the story take me where it's going, as opposed to sitting down and say, well, you know, chapter 10 is going to be this and chapter 4 is this. And I don't know that. Mm-hmm. I have no idea what I'm going to write about and how it's going to end when I sit down to write. None. Zero. But I know certain segments and I kind of fill it in and I sort of develop the characters and their reactions as they go along.
Amazing. What do you want, or what, if there is something you would like readers to take away from your books, what would that be?
Love is paramount, but love can be blind, and true love can be truly blind, because as the relationship between these two guys develop, the young guy really becomes a sociopath. Yet this older guy doesn't see it. He can't see it. The love gets in the way.
It sounds very powerful. And I can really sort of understand why maybe some readers would be more drawn to the first two and other readers be more drawn to the latter. Do they need to be read in order? Is it a time?
No, they can stand by themselves. But I think you get more out of it if you read it in order, because I tried to make just the littlest references to previous events in previous novels so that it didn't interfere with the current book you're in, you know, reading. But so they can stand alone. They all can stand alone. But it's a richer experience if you start with number one and work your way through, I think, because you kind of get a richer idea, a deeper understanding of why the characters are doing certain things.
Well, I know what's going to go on my to-be-read list as an avid reader. We are shortly coming to the end of the interview, which has gone by so, so quickly. But before we do that, you did say you were taking a break from writing. So what does that look like for you?
Well, I already have almost 6 pages of handwritten notes for my fifth novel. But I refuse, and as a thought occurs to me, I do write it down, but I refuse to start reading what I just, that, because once I start to reread what I wrote, it means I'm going to start writing again, and I have to get my life back. I like my life. I'm a good cook. I like to do dinner parties. And when I start writing, nobody hears from me. Yeah. I mean, some of my friends down here said, what happened to you? We haven't seen you or heard from you in months. I said, well, I know, but I'm just about to publish my next book. And oh, now they understand. But, you know, I would rather like to have my, for a year, I'm going to do traveling. I want to get my life back a little bit before I dive into the fifth novel.
Well, that makes a lot of sense to me, but it also sounds you get very lost in a lovely way in your art, and that is sort of part of what helps you write. So, you know, the four books came together, but now it's time for you to maybe sit back and go on some adventures yourself.
You couldn't have put it better. Yes, exactly right. And I'm not saying I'll never write another book, but not for a while.
And you never know, on your own travels, more ideas might come to you.
And how.
Exactly. Thank you so, so much for speaking with us and shout out. If people would like to read your books, and I would imagine many, many will, how do they get hold of them?
Well, they're all listed on my website, markaxt.com. And my last name, it's Mark, M-A-R-K. And my last name is a little difficult to spell. A-K, S as in Sam, T as in Tom. markaxt.com, and that links to Amazon.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Mark. It's been an absolute pleasure, and we wish you a wonderful break from writing, but we do think you're going to be coming back to it in not too long.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure being here.
Thank you.
Shout out.
LGBT radio for you.
The Shout Out Podcast.
There you go. That's, where is it? It's on my scripts. You will see that's by Quarterhead and SESA. We think it's SESA. It's that or it's SESA. It was all in block caps, so I don't know. I just like the song.
Sorry, who's it by? That's the first time I think I've caused radio silence. Can't normally shut me up.
It wasn't my fault.
No, it wasn't.
Oh dear.
That was a great track, actually. Really enjoyed it.
I like it. It's a bit of a bouncy one, yeah. Isn't it? So, anyway, we're running a little bit behind, so we're going to go straight into it. But are you two ready for some news?
Yeah.
Cool.
Okie doke.
This is Shoutout News. Welcome along.
The Netherlands has made history this week as Rob Jetten was sworn in as the country's first openly gay prime minister. At just 38, he is also the youngest leader in Dutch history. Jetten, who has long been a visible advocate for LGBTQI+ equality, climate action and democratic reform, leads a minority coalition formed after months of negotiation following last October's election. His appointment has been wildly welcomed by LGBTQI+ groups across Europe, who says it sends a powerful message at a time when rights are under pressure in several countries. Speaking after the ceremony in The Hague, Jetten said he hoped his leadership would show young people that politics belongs to everyone, no matter who you are or who you love.
A press release from the trans-affirming members of Manchester Women's Institute has gone viral after the group announced it will close. Members said that the WI's December 2025 decision to exclude transgender women from membership was incompatible with the ethos of their branch, which has always operated on principles of inclusion and mutual support. The Manchester group says that after consulting members, it became clear that too few were willing to take up officer roles under the new rules, making it impossible for the them to continue. The branch, founded in 2012, had been known for its community craft projects, charity fundraising, and outspoken support for LGBTQ plus rights. In their statement, members said the decision was taken with sadness, but with integrity. And they thanked everyone who had been a part of their community over the past 14 years.
Pink News reports that Girl Guiding UK has been offered legal support by the Good Law Project if it chooses to reinstate trans-inclusive membership policies. The charity had restricted membership for Rainbows, Brownies, Guides and Rangers on the basis of biological sex, citing a 2024 Supreme Court ruling on the Equality Act. The Good Law Project says that while the ruling clarified certain definitions, it does not prevent organisations from adopting inclusive policies if they choose to do so. The group says it has obtained independent legal advice confirming that trans-inclusive membership remains lawful, but that the threat of litigation from gender-critical groups has created a chilling effect. Thousands of current and former Girl Guiding members have signed open letters urging the charity to reaffirm its commitment to supporting all girls, both trans and cis, and to resist what they describe as organised pressure to exclude vulnerable young people.
In Spain, the Constitutional Court has declined to suspend the country's 2023 gender self-determination law, whilst appeals continue, meaning that the law remains in force. The legislation allows people aged 16 or over to change legal gender without medical or psychological assessment, with judicial pathways for younger teens. Spain's Equality Ministry has welcomed the court's decision, saying that it protects the dignity and autonomy of trans people whilst legal challenges are resolved. The law was one of the flagship reforms of Spain's previous progressive coalition government and brought the country into line with several other European nations that have adopted self-ID models. Opponents have argued for tighter controls, but LGBTQ plus organisations say the law has already made a significant difference to the lives of young trans people who previously faced long delays and invasive medical scrutiny.
Meanwhile, in Italy, the government continues to face public backlash over policies affecting LGBTQ plus families. Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni's administration has instructed local authorities to remove the names of non-biological same-sex parents from children's birth certificates, a move the activist says leaves families in legal limbo. Several mayors have refused to comply, calling the directive discriminatory and harmful to children's welfare. At the same time, proposed legislation would restrict discussion of LGBTQI plus topics in schools, drawing comparisons to the Don't Say Gay laws introduced in parts of the US. Tens of thousands of people have taken part in protests across Milan, Rome and Bologna, with organisers saying Italy is moving backwards on equality. European human rights groups have warned that the policy risks isolating Italy from wider EU norms on family rights and anti-discrimination protections.
In Australia, the state of Victoria has passed landmark legislation banning medically unnecessary surgeries on children born with variations in sex characteristics. The law, passed 19th of February, makes Victoria the first Australian state and the second jurisdiction nationally after the ACT to introduce such protections. Intersex advocacy groups have campaigned for decades for an end to non-consensual non-consensual surgeries performed on infants and children for social or cosmetic reasons rather than urgent medical need. The Victoria government says that the reforms will ensure that irreversible interventions cannot take place unless essential for a child's physical health, safeguarding bodily autonomy until individuals are old enough to give informed consent. Human rights organisations have praised the legislation as a model for other states and countries to follow.
Tributes are being paid to pioneering HIV and LGBT rights campaigner Martin Butler, co-founder of the Terence Higgins Trust, who has died suddenly. Butler helped establish Europe's first HIV response organisation in 1982 following the death of his friend Terry Higgins. In the early days of the epidemic, when fear and misinformation were widespread, Butler played a crucial role in getting accurate information to the public. He organised the Trust's first fundraiser, designed its first leaflet and even used his home phone number as the UK's first AIDS helpline. Over the decades, he remained a dedicated supporter of the charity, speaking at events, mentoring young activists and championing the rights of people living with HIV. His work was recognised with an OBE in 2022, and colleagues have described him as a giant of compassion, courage, and community spirit.
And finally, as Eurovision season begins to warm up, LGBTQ plus visibility is once again taking centre stage. Several countries have already announced openly LGBTQ plus artists for the 2026 contest, continuing a long tradition of queer representation at Europe's biggest music event. Eurovision has long been celebrated as a joyful, defiant space for LGBTQ plus culture. From Dana International's groundbreaking win in 1998 to Conchita Wurst's victory in 2014 and the many queer performers who have followed. Fans say that the contest remains one of the few international stages where LGBTQ plus artists can perform without compromise. An early preview suggests this year's lineup will continue that legacy. With national finals underway and rehearsals beginning soon, excitement is building for what many expect to be one of the most vibrant and inclusive contests yet.
Thank you for listening to Shout Out News this week. Check out our website at shoutoutradio.lgbt and stay tuned to community radio and podcasts.
For Shout Out News, this has been Terry Starr
and Ezra Peregrine.
Shout Out News.
National and international LGBT news for you.
Shout Out.
LGBT radio for you.
The Shout Out Podcast.
I love that one. That's Where Is My Husband by Ray. So, ironically, he sat opposite me and Terry's pointing at him. Yeah. Arby said when she saw the track listing earlier, like, did you do that because your husband's on the show? I'm like, no, actually, because we were originally having a different guest, weren't we?
Serendipitous, I think is the word.
Absolutely, yes.
So, hello, husband.
Hello.
So,
how are all you lovely people this evening?
Very nice, yes. Those of you on the podcast might recognise the voice. Can you say it again?
What, the accent you mean?
No, you say the Shout Out Podcast.
Oh, I did, it was a very long time ago.
It was 15 years ago.
Still using that jingle, yes.
Still used to, because we have to edit out the music, don't we?
Yeah.
Now, we're actually here talking about something completely different, and that's Southwest Fetish, which is a group, which I'll let you introduce, actually. But before we go into the group and what it's about, one of the things I wanted to clarify is the minute you say the word fetish, a lot of people think, oh, it's all that dirty, sleazy stuff that goes on in the bedroom. It's very much not, is it?
Well,
so what does fetish... Well, it does cover that as well. The bit that we're talking about here is more of a social meetup, isn't it? But why?
Yeah, so we get together socially every couple of months, mainly to get people out from behind the apps, because you can talk to people online till the cows come home, but they're no substitute for actually getting out and meeting somebody in person. And particularly when you're talking about kink and fetish, because it's so important to have consent and negotiation and trust. And that comes from meeting people face to face. And if we can provide an environment where people can meet face to face safely in a no pressure environment, then it just helps people to be more comfortable with what they're wanting to explore.
Yeah. Yeah, and we should point out, so what kind of venues do you meet in?
We always meet in a public venue, so often a bar in, because we're Bristol based, often a bar in Old Market, so that we're not in a closed private space, because it's a social, not a play event, and that means that we're open to everybody. Absolutely everybody over the age of 18 can come and join us. You don't have to have anything specific in mind. You don't have to have all the latest expensive gear, you know, just if you're just interested, if you're just curious, come along. And that really is open to everybody. Even though we're a group that's run by a small group of gay men, we're open to gay people, straight people, trans people, MBs. Absolutely everybody. Yeah,
cool. I mean, that is a big question, isn't it? Because, I mean, leather and rubber have a tradition going back. Oh, gosh, I should ask Terry. He's our kind of history expert. I believe leather certainly goes back to pre-war, does it not?
There are erotic drawings, of course, from ancient times, and there are, you know, the Pompeii, the ruined city, is full of erotic frescoes and things like that, and people performing all sorts of sexual acts on each other, and I mean, no leather, but you know, they're certainly, you know, well, what person isn't turned on by a Roman gladiator's uniform? That's quite a big, quite a big thing even today, isn't it? So, you know, and in terms of the more recent sort of socialisation, Carl probably know more about it, but the motorcycle groups of the 1940s and 50s mm-hmm. provided a cover for gay men who were into leather and rubber to sort of wear that kind of gear out in public. So there's a long history.
But also I think it's important to say that even though when you talk about fetish and kink, people's minds automatically go to the leather and rubber whips and chains and all that sort of thing, but it's fetish doesn't have to be about the gear. It can also be about something that you enjoy particularly. I'm thinking about a conversation I had quite a long time ago.
Trainers is
with,
a classic one,
oh, that's,
isn't it?
That's, you know, very popular now. But I had a conversation with someone who he was saying, oh, I haven't got any fetishes, don't do all that sort of thing. And when I talked to him about it and asked him what did he really, really enjoy doing, what really got his motor going, it turned out that he really, really got fruity when he was on the sofa with his wife watching Coronation Street. And that's what really worked for him. So I said, okay, so even though you might not define it as that, that's your fetish.
Never going to listen to that. That's what really gets you. The same way again, are we?
If for whatever reason, if that particular situation is what really gets you going, that's your kink, you know.
Fair enough. Yeah, no, it is true. No, I'm laughing. I've just got the Coronation Street theme tune in my head now. So how often are you getting together a meeting at the moment?
So we had a bit of a hiatus over Christmas and New Year. We are getting together next month in March. And for a change for us, we're actually getting together on a Sunday, so Sunday the 22nd. Normally we'd meet on a kind of Saturday evening, but because of what we're doing in the social that we're having in March, we're getting together on kind of Sunday afternoon, so we can have a bit of a quieter space.
Cool. And what's kind of planned?
Oh, so we like to try and do something different each time, so that we're not just getting together in a pub for a drink and a chat. So in March we're getting together, and we've got someone coming in to do a hypnosis fetish demo. And because myself and the other members of the team aren't particularly expert in that, we're bringing someone in who knows what they're doing. A lovely person called Buck is coming in, and he is doing a session that will start off looking at the ethics of hypnotism, because obviously ethics and consent is always really, really important. Then he'll go on to take the group through how to put someone under a trance. I hope I'm using the right terminology, because like I said, I'm not an expert in it. And then he'll finish off talking about what you can and can't do with hypnotism, so that people don't leave with unrealistic expectations.
Yeah, I mean, because we don't know much about hypnotism, but there are a lot of myths out there, like it stays forever, and if someone clicks their fingers, Tom Daly appears underneath the stairs, doesn't he? <Terry? laughs>
If only it worked like that.
it's quite a scene, isn't it? There is a erotic hypnotism scene which is popular amongst both heterosexual and LGBTQ plus.
Yeah,
I think a lot of fetish. I don't think it's unique to LGBT people.
I think we're just more open about it. We find it easier to talk about it generally. Yeah. My understanding is that kind of when you are put into a hypnotic trance, it's very similar going into a term that in the kink community we call subspace, which is a kind of a state of mind where you're more compliant and more suggestive, and you feel like you're more willing to go along with what's being suggested. And again, with that, it's really important to go back to what I was saying about consent and ethics, and that a session wouldn't involve you being made to do something that you don't want to do. Yeah. I know that's a big fear for people with hypnosis, that they'll suddenly find themselves or afterwards will have found themselves to have done something that they wouldn't necessarily want to do. But again,
I mean, I guess that's a good thing to, because one of the things that, there's two things you tend to find concern people who've not been along before that might potentially be interested. One, have I got to spend a fortune on all the kit? And the answer's obviously no.
No, well, I mean, with hypnosis, literally all you need is two brains.
Well, I'm on about actually telling you something like a Southwest fetish meat, for example. You know. But there's also that, and also the whole thing of consent. Now, obviously, your meetups are social, so there's nothing. But I mean, is consent something that you make quite a big thing about?
Oh, definitely.
General?
Yeah, definitely, all the time. So, there's been a kind of growing movement, certainly across the UK, in the kink groups that do meet in a social space, where we talk about gear doesn't equal consent. And that comes from when the social events started becoming really popular, you would be out in a public space, and because of what you were wearing, people felt it was okay to touch and pull up what you were wearing and slap your bum and all that sort of thing. And that's not okay because it's touching without consent. And that's kind of at a very basic level. But one of the things that we do a lot is we talk about consent and we talk about negotiation. And when new people come along, we'll talk about what their expectations are and what they think kink is, and then talk to them about the fact that, and it sounds really boring, but that negotiation is probably the most important thing. That you sit down before you do anything and you talk about what you'd like to do, what you definitely wouldn't like to do, and what you expect. And so you kind of, perhaps not as far as going as like writing a script out, but you kind of plan what is going to be involved in whatever you're planning to do before it happens.
And I'm guessing that's ridiculously important when you're talking about putting yourself into a hypnotic trance.
Yep.
Because you can't then give consent
in any situation where you're giving up any control. So whether it's hypnosis or being tied up or agreeing to be told what to do for an evening, or you know, any of those situations, consent and negotiation is the first thing that anybody should be thinking of.
Cool. I mean, so this one's hypnosis.
Mm-hmm.
They do change. What other things have you done? What might come in the future?
So we've done things in the summer. We ran a kinky quiz that went down very well. That was a lot of fun. We gave away a range of kinky surprises. No, kinky prizes. They were surprises, but yeah, kinky prizes. And that was things like free entries to the local what do I want to call it? Private kink club, play kink night, up to kind of gear and equipment and vouchers for rubber stores and things like that. So, you know, we've done things like that. We've done photo shoots where we invite people to come down in their favorite gear that they want to show off and take photos for their
profiles, right,
or for their own private use. It's slightly random, but we did a kinky Banksy walk. Obviously, Bristol's very well known for its Banksy artwork. So we had a group meet up, and some were wearing their rubber and leather. Some were just in their ordinary, in their civvies.
It's quite varied then. There's some things that are more of a fetish element, and some that are very, very social.
Yeah, completely. And that's the whole point. And it's like any social group. It's bringing together a group of people with a common interest.
Cool. Well, I mean, it's one of those subjects that we really must do a deep dive into one of these days, especially around the consent thing. It's a huge thing at the moment, isn't it? But we are running out of time. Say when the next event is, and how do people find out more about it?
So a couple of things there. The event is at To The Moon on Midland Road in Old Market. On Sunday, March the 22nd, we're starting at 5 p.m. and the hypnosis demo will start at 6. Because hypnosis is quite a small, intimate thing, we're actually doing a registration for it. So we only have a limited number of spaces. So if you find us on our socials at Southwest Fetish, you'll find an Eventbrite link that you can go to book your place. It's completely free, doesn't cost anything. And also, if you don't reserve a space for the hypnosis demo, you can still come along to the social as well. That's absolutely fine.
Cool. Well, Ez has asked, can you put Steph in for it?
Yeah, well, it depends. what does she want Steph to be hypnotized? I mean, I know she's got a dinosaur fetish, so you know, I'm sure Steph could do a really good T-Rex or a Velociraptor.
Anyway, thanks for joining us, and best of luck with it.
Always a pleasure.
Stay with us. You're listening to Shout Out. Back in a minute.
The Shout Out Podcast.
Tocker's Miracle, that one. That's from the year 2000, that, believe it or not, actually. That's by Fragma. So I love that one. Reminds me of being young.
We should probably play something more modern at some point. I don't know.
Well, we did. I mean, some of the ones earlier were like, Where's My Husband? That was last year.
Oh, yeah, that's quite recent, isn't it? Yeah.
You Will See was only last year.
That's right. Yeah.
Is that a queer we hear?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. But 26 years, what constitutes a vintage song?
I had this one in from a week or two ago when we were actually purposely doing like nostalgic tracks. Because technically it's History Month, you know.
Still. It is, yeah. We're still LGBTQ
still the end of History Month. So... it's coming to an end, actually. Where are we now? We're the 26th.
Almost March.
So, depending on which station you're listening on, it's already finished.
It is. March on Sunday. St. David's Day.
Oh, yes.
So happy St. David's Day to our Welsh listeners.
Indeed.
Then the 5th of March will be St. Piran's Day for the Cornish.
So, I always forget Pancake Day. Did anyone remember Pancake Day? Have pancakes?
Yeah. It was a Super Tuesday, actually, because a very rare conjunction on Tuesday, the 17th. It was the first night of Ramadan, the Islamic holy month of fasting and charitable works. It was Shrove Tuesday, which brings in the Christian period of fasting for Lent. And it was also Imbolc full moon, a new moon, I beg your pardon, which is important in the pagan calendar. So all those three things coincided. That doesn't happen very often.
Lots of fasting.
Yeah. You giving anything up for Lent?
Not that I'm admitting to on the radio.
Right. Well, you see, giving up that is quite important to some people.
No, I've never. No, I know it's very important to some people. No, it's not something I've ever done. I just every single year, Pancake Day comes round and goes, and I'm like, oh damn, I didn't make a pancake.
No.
And I don't have very much of a sweet tooth, so it's quite unusual.
So what would you have on your pancake?
Oh, it would have to be maple syrup.
Oh, lemon and sugar.
Traditional style.
I know, but then you get a bit that's got no sugar and it's just pure lemon.
That's the best bit.
So some people like Nutella, don't they?
They do, yeah.
Is that crepes or pancakes we're talking about here?
Is this... Well, I mean, it's a British... We call it a pancake. You know, they are based on crepes, aren't they? Which come across from France, so they're the thin
horrible
ones,
things.
Aren't they? You don't like them, no? Are you going to say you don't like Yorkshire pudding next either?
Oh, I love Yorkshire pudding. Yeah, come on now. Lots of fat. I'm Scottish.
So some people do have the savoury pancakes.
Yeah,
that can be quite nice. Cheese pancake or something.
Or egg and bacon in a pancake as well.
It's supposed to be using up all your material in your fridge.
All the fatty stuff, all the bad stuff before you go on your fast. Yeah.
What, the pancake?
Yeah, isn't it?
I don't know.
That's the whole principle.
That you're supposed to use up everything it's...
We'd literally have nothing left in our fridge if we used all
the fatty stuff. Oatmeal for the rest of this 40 days.
Anyway, enough talk of pancakes, making me hungry. That's it for this week. If you have an event or story, or perhaps you'd even like to get involved in LGBT plus radio, please check us out online and get in touch.
Plus, all our shows are available as podcasts on all good services, as well as at our website, shoutoutradio.lgbt.
Now, I'm hoping I've got it right this time. Next week, not in my name. Yes?
Yes? Correct, yes? Mr. Shilton. Good. Correct.
From myself and the rest of the team, say bye-bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Shout out. LGBT Radio for you.